We are blessed to have Contemplative Outreach put this on for us, but we're also blessed that our pastor is here to give us a blessing this morning. Pastor Matt Mello, thank you.
Thank you, Tony, and it's our pleasure on behalf of the staff and the community of Divine Mercy to host this wonderful group. Anything that we can do to promote our faith and spirituality and by extending our hospitality here in this wonderful pavilion, it's truly our pleasure. So we want to say not only thank you to those members of Divine Mercy, but also the representatives from Contemplative Outreach of Central Florida. So if you could join me in a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Father, we learn to find you in the silence, and it is there that you speak to our heart. Bless this day, and bless this group. They seek to draw closer to you through this wonderful tradition of contemplative prayer. And bless everyone and their families through Christ our Lord. Amen. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. And again, on behalf of Divine Mercy, welcome.
Good morning, everyone. It's so good to have you with us this morning. My name is Kathy Kotis, and I'm coordinator of Contemplative Outreach of Central Florida. Just a bit about Contemplative Outreach. We are a spiritual network that supports individuals and groups in their centering prayer practice. Thomas Merton writes in his book, New Seeds of Contemplation, that St. Thomas Aquinas believed that all will be contemplatives in heaven, but many will breathe this new atmosphere while still on earth. In celebrating this centenary of Thomas Merton's birth, we're also recognizing the continuing and powerful influence of these new seeds that Merton planted with his teachings. Today we're very fortunate to have a speaker who has studied Thomas Merton for 40 years and is deeply involved in continuing the Merton legacy. Dr. Gray Matthews is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Memphis, where he teaches courses in listening, dialogue, and contemplative communication. Don't you wish you'd studied that in college? He has served the International Thomas Merton Society as a member of the board of directors, coordinator of the Memphis chapter of ITMS, and is past co-editor of the Merton Annual, and has published articles in the Merton Annual and Merton Seasonal. Gray is also a member of the Lay Cistercians of Gethsemane. He teaches a range of courses on contemplative spirituality and the Christian mystics for his Catholic diocese in Memphis. Those courses have included studies on Merton, Eckhart, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, and a book familiar to those who practice centering prayer, The Cloud of Unknowing. He also has taught listening as a spiritual practice. He and his wife Lynn and their two daughters attend the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in Memphis. We're very honored to have Gray with us, and perhaps there may be more seeds, new seeds of contemplation sown today. So please welcome Dr. Gray Matthews.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. I've got things all over the place. This is the time in my head when I always hear my friends and family go, uh-oh. Gray's going to speak. I always feel reckless, and none of you know me. I've only met a couple of people since yesterday, and I have to be honest with you. I feel completely apprehensive in talking to you. You couldn't have picked an odder speaker in the world, is the way I feel. I have no idea what to tell you. If you've come to hear me, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what you think and how you live. Now, I know some things. I'm kind of kidding, but I have to kind of do that to make myself feel comfortable and find a kind of rhythm in the room as I look around. And I would like to be real with you, and I would like to communicate with you. I would like you to think, and I'd like you to deal with your own life, not mine. I have no packaged plan. I've got a plan. I've got a hefty handout, but I'm probably not going to follow it very well. And in fact, the number arrangement is already messed up. When I made copies, I decided to move things around at the last minute, and kind of reserve the right to change my own mind if I get a better idea. So I decided to put some color paper in there in certain places. So forget the numbers. Colors, I think, order the world a lot better than numbers anyway. So I'll give you a little taste of this handout. It's also a little reckless to start talking after centering prayer, after we've been quiet. And so I feel like I'm going to wreck, like a wrecking ball. I'm going to wreck the room and just kind of flow through here and knock over people like bowling pins, or start calling out some bingo numbers, or do something. But I like to have fun in not taking myself seriously. But I have fun going very deep. So very quickly, we're just going to go deep. And if there's anything I know about centering prayer and contemplative outreach and people who do this regularly, they can go deep rather quickly. You don't need someone to kind of coach you, and you just takes about a moment to start to deal with your life and in the sense of what is real. And that's what we'll work with. If I can kind of introduce you to the handout for a moment, of course, the front cover is kind of got what... the theme of the day. We've got Merton, of course. Happy birthday to Thomas Merton. It was last month, January 31st, the 100th anniversary of his life, of his birth. There's a conference in June celebrating that, and they'll have several hundred people there for that, I'm sure. The commotion is a term that I use for the modern world that we live in. It's just this blur. And I'll say a few things about that. And then, of course, you know about contemplation. The term long art I want to kind of introduce you to today. This is a phrase that I've come to use myself. And I'm going to have a sabbatical this fall. I teach communication courses, as Kathy said. And I have a sabbatical this fall, and I'm going to write a book. At least I have the intent. And the name of the book is The Long Art. And it's about contemplation. And the thing that Merton has most introduced me to and stunned me with is contemplation. And as I started reading Merton, I started realizing I was contemplating life. And I started realizing I have been doing this all my life. And I started to realize that I was born contemplative, and then I even started to realize as years went by, and this is a kind of radical notion, I'll just put it on the table for you to think about, but I don't think in terms of active people and contemplative people. I think we are all, as human beings, contemplative and active. Before we're even religious, I think we're contemplative beings. And the long art is the practice of contemplation in our short life. Here's where the phrase comes from. It starts with Hippocrates. You're familiar with the Greek philosopher who was a doctor, the Hippocratic Oath. He had one of his phrases was ars longa vita brevis, which meant short life. Life is short, but art is long. He didn't do much more with that. He just said, here's a little witticism, take this. But a little later, a Roman philosopher by the name of Seneca wrote a wonderful essay, which you can still get. You can order it in a normal book or get it online, called The Shortness of Life. And he takes Hippocrates to task. Life is short, not because it's actually short, but because we waste it. And we waste it because we do not contemplate. And we should start contemplating when we're young. And Seneca's essay is written to a young guy he knows and admires, and he is trying to emphatically get him to take the time. Don't even worry about leisure, because everybody, this is 45 AD or CE, Common Era. So just shortly after Christ died, Seneca is writing his philosophy, and he's certainly not a Christian, but the Christian church kind of read him and preserved his writings because he was in sync with them a little bit. But he talked, and this is, we have to kind of think about this. 2,000 years ago, people were still speeding through their life, missing their whole life. Well, we kind of feel like we've got a guarantee on that situation. We're the ones that created it. You know, hang on, ancient Roman Greece. We created airplanes and electricity and all this kind of stuff. We know how to jet through life. But they were doing it. And we would look back and go, well, you don't have anything to do. You don't have plumbing? You don't have jobs like we do? You don't have to work 9 to 5? But they were living and not living. And we still know what that is, but they knew what that was. And so I read this essay, The Shortness of Life, and it just coincided with everything that I'd read in Merton. This was a few years later that I kind of discovered this and began thinking about the long art of contemplation in a short life. And I'll say a little bit more about that as we go along. So that's a phrase that I'm using. I think I'm the only one on earth using that. So please do not feel like you need to use that. Or don't go tell somebody about the long art. They won't know what you're talking about. But if I write this book and it gets out, then maybe somebody can talk about the long art of contemplation. But I'm thinking in my head today that contemplation is not something we do on the side when we're having a nice, good, golden moment. It runs through our whole being. We are contemplative from top to bottom. From the beginning of our life, we have already started contemplating, but we cut that short, and then we get caught up in a world of action. But our contemplation, in my mind, in my experience, and this to me is what Merton has taught me, is that contemplation is how we as human beings receive divine life. Contemplation is a receptive force or capacity. And our action is response to what is given to us. So God has already given us His life. We wouldn't exist as human beings as soon as we're born if it wasn't for God. So I feel like every ounce of my self is that I was born contemplative in the sense that I was born to receive God's life, His promises, and that this is eternal. This goes forever. But I do have this short material kind of world of existence in which I act. But if I start to understand contemplation as really almost a divine birthright, in a sense, my action is a response to what is given to me. So how I act in this life, how I live out my life, is how I live out what is given to me by God. So this is a kind of rhythm. And so when we have practice centering prayer and then some nut gets up and starts talking, we need to realize that that language and that speaking, that's a kind of action, but it's rooted in that centering prayer. It's language in our communication is rooted in that silence. And there's a rhythm to that, and that is a spiritual rhythm. Yesterday I met Joe and Tony and Father Jim, and Father Jim has been very patient with me. We've had some very warm conversations, and I feel like I've been here a little while. And when we got to the residence where I'm staying, the first thing I did, and I was tickled to do this like a little kid, is I went out to the ocean. Now, I know you know about the ocean. I've been to the ocean many times in my life, but I still need to just go right out to that ocean and establish that contact again. I stole a couple of shells. It's just kind of something we have to do. But to go out there, and I'm so grateful to be staying in a place where I'm hearing the ocean, and I'm hearing that constant waving sound, that just like silence in speech, there's something calming and rhythmical about that ocean, something real about it, something communicative about the ocean. I sense the same thing in forest when you get into the quiet of a forest. And maybe you hear birds, maybe you hear the wind like a breeze through chimes, as if the trees are musical themselves. There's a rhythm in all of this, and it's in existence itself. So this is kind of how I'm thinking contemplation and action. They can't be possibly divorced. Our action is a response to the life that we have received. And when we practice contemplation and whenever we center ourselves in silence, we are getting to the root of our very existence. We're not just being quiet and calm. And it's a momentous thing. If you look at the handout, now I said I was going to introduce it, and I started, that's kind of what I do. I just kind of go off. Look at the back of the and at the gold page. Here's an image that I created to kind of simplify the movement of our souls, in a sense, for today. There, it's a line that gone down the middle. It's like a plumb line. And so the wording at the bottom is, if you're familiar with plumbs, when architects and builders and contractors are working, trying to get a wall straight, and they hang this plumb line, and it's supposed to become still. And something about silence and stillness, something about those in solitude, something about simplicity, all of those are contemplative conditions. And so when we're centering in prayer, and we're centering in silence, to me we're centering our life in God, in this plumb line has to go through, however, commotion. And the commotion is this mess, it's this noise, it's this constant activity that's not action. It's this almost fever. It's a nervousness. It's a kind of, we'll get into it a little bit more. There's a page in here on commotion, and it's defined in all kinds of ways. But you know about commotion when your life is in a kind of upheaval. Merton is going to tell us a little bit about a necessary interior upheaval. And I'll come back to that in a moment. What I've chosen to do for the four conferences today, and please don't think these are going to go on too long. In fact, that reminds me, let me get my phone out to keep track of time. I have to stop talking when I look at the clock. I can't process my words and the time at the same time. In fact, you can't breathe and talk at the same time. I don't know if you know this. You cannot breathe and talk at the same time. There's a beautiful, if you don't mind me walking around a little bit, there's, I think, if you've ever read the Upanishads, which is Indian literature, Indian spirituality, it's a some beautiful works of life and being. And there's one called the Kathka Upanishad. And the there's a line in it that I'll never forget about. When we speak, we sacrifice breath. When we breathe, we sacrifice speech. We sacrifice talk. You cannot do the both at the same time. You could experiment, just start talking, and you'll go maybe a minute, minute and a half tops, and then you won't be able to talk, and you will gasp for breath because you can't just keep talking. So we have to breathe and we have to talk. But it's a beautiful, beautiful spiritual principle that when we're silent, we are giving up talking. And we have to breathe to live. We don't have to talk to live, really. But we do have to breathe to live. So when we do speak, it's got to be married to that silence. It's got to be married to the breath and the life of our life. And back to contemplation. And what is our life and where does it come from? Whenever we are contemplative, we are receiving, acknowledging, affirming the life that we are, not just our biological life, but our very existence. That is given to us by God. So when we talk, we got to be a little careful. Now, even though I said that, I'm still going to get a little reckless, and I may get a little silly at times. And I have to do this to kind of still, as I told you, to kind of get comfortable. And you'll see as this goes. I'm just preparing for you. I know people back home that would like me to tell you what's going to happen in the next few minutes. And I'm doing my best to kind of warn you. I'm trying to fit in, too. Let's see how this goes. All right, so the blue sheets inside. This is what we're going to kind of work on over the morning. And we'll turn to that and get started with that in a moment. And then after the blue pages, there is a white page. It's got sort of a chronology of Merton's life. I'm going to go over that a little bit over these four sessions, taking a little bit at a time. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Merton's life today, though you know some things. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some thoughts that he has about silence and solitude to kind of ground these four sessions. I'm going to tell you a little bit, because I cannot help it, about how I think and feel and wonder and read Merton. But I'm most concerned that you cultivate this, all of this thinking and sensing within your own soul, and that you work within yourself. And like that plumb line that goes all the way down. We're going to read a poem in a little while, maybe after lunch, about by Merton called All the Way Down. And when he's talking about going deep, he's talking about going inside. He's talking about interiority. He's talking about silence. And he's talking for real about doing this and not just going so far to where you're comfortable. But you have to go all the way down. It's almost like you go down to the bottom. And for Merton, you got to go below the bottom. If you've hit bottom, you've got to go deeper than that. We'll see what kind of sense this makes. And I hope I don't drive you crazy with this kind of talk. But we're going to go all the way down today. And I'm wanting you to do this. And I'll try to do it with you. But that's coming up. What would be interesting to you later, we may just touch on it, but this salmon color, would you say that was salmon? Okay, good. You got to coordinate your colors. I mean, if you can get anything right, you got to know your colors. So the salmon is a letter that Merton wrote to a Muslim named Abdul Aziz. And this letter is, he was asked by the Muslim, how do you pray as a Christian? And he talked about centering. And this is where the centering prayer, at least according to Menninger and Pennington, and I think Keating would say so too, that they all three kind of came from Merton's kinds of conceptions and articulations about centering. So those who practice centering prayer, you may like to read this letter from Merton to Aziz explaining how he centered himself. And we may take a look at that a little bit later. I put some references about contemplation on here and some because this was the key theme in Merton's life. That's another white sheet. Some key terms that we won't get into. It's just something you can have and read later. If you're new to Merton, it might be helpful. The gold sheet, the other side of it, of the plumb line, is some things I've written about the commotion, kind of abbreviated definitions. So that's what we're kind of looking at. The first two white pages are blank at the back, so if you think of any thoughts you want to write down to yourself, not something I'm saying, but something that you're thinking, please do that. So let's turn to this first blue page. $10.15, that's not bad. I was really worried about starting to talk to you, and I don't know how you're feeling, but I'm feeling better now. I'm feeling a little better. It takes me about 15 minutes, I think. So let me just read the first paragraph on this opening. This is from Merton's Thoughts in Solitude. I think there are a couple copies left, so if you have not bought any books, you might want to grab this one before the day is over. Thoughts in Solitude. He wrote it in the 50s, and I'm going to take some quotes from that book. It's a beautiful book. And from the beginning of that book by Merton, his own introduction, that first paragraph, he writes, "There is no greater disaster in the spiritual life than to be immersed in unreality. Our life is maintained and nourished in us by our vital relation with realities outside and above us. When our life feeds on unreality, it must starve. It must therefore die. There is no greater misery than to mistake this fruitless death for the true, faithful, and sacrificial death by which we enter into life." Now that's just how he kind of starts the book. And we could take that paragraph, I promise you, we could stay with that all day long. We could take every three or four words and kind of hunker down and think about what does this mean. He's saying quite a bit. I added some more things. I'm not even going to read those out loud. This is enough. What I'll pull out of this, though, to start, is that Merton, in his sense of contemplation and the monastic life, the silent life, the spiritual life, was, if it was about anything, it was about reality. He didn't want just a religious life. So he was a little rambunctious when he came into the monastery, in a sense. He had not lived a religious life. If you turn to the white page, I won't keep you dizzy, but if you would like to look at some of those dates, let me tell you a little bit about Merton's life, the early years before the monastery. And then we'll go back to the blue page and read a paragraph about attention. an attention to reality. This is Merton. To me, this is one way today to talk about Merton, is that Merton wanted to attend to reality. He didn't want anything else. Henry David Thoreau is another person I love to read and study and learn from. Talked about reality in the same way. He says, I want to feel reality. I want to feel it in my bones. If it's not real, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Just give me reality. It was a craving of his soul. Not a fake life, not a fake existence. Now that's someone who Seneca, the Roman philosopher, would have understood. Don't give me this quick and dirty kind of spiel of an exciting life. What is really life? And I'm life. What am I really? And what am I in life? I don't want any fancy answers. I don't want a program or a plan. That's why Merton is a little rambunctious for some people. He's a mystic. And that can be trouble. And we may come back to that as well. All right, let's look at some of the early years about Merton and get a sense of how he starts on this road to be attentive to reality and why he would be so concerned with this. He's born in France. It's not until the 50s that he becomes an American citizen. So Merton is born in France. His mother was from New York. She was a Quaker. His father was from New Zealand. He was not religious, though his family had maybe they'd gone to an Australian Anglican kind of situation, church, but they didn't have any religious perspective, no teachings. They didn't go to any churches. So Merton had no religious upbringing. His parents were both artists, and they traveled a good bit. So they met, I think, maybe in England. So they're living in France, and Thomas is born. He's their first child. They have another son a couple years later named John Paul. He's born in 1918. John Paul is going to later die quite young in a during World War II. I'll say something about that. So Merton loses his whole family quite young. So he's 6 years old when his mother, Ruth, her last name was Jenkins, dies. And when Merton went to the hospital, his mother didn't want him to come into the hospital. So his father made him sit in the car outside the hospital. He's 6 years old, just a little boy. And he's dealing with the awesomeness of this experience, and he doesn't have anybody to counsel him. And he certainly doesn't have any religious inspiration, and what do you say at this point? So it's a very, your heart kind of goes out to a kid who's dealing with something all by himself. But this is how Merton has kind of come into the world a little bit. But his mother wrote a beautiful little book. It's a mother's book. It's called Tom's Book. And you can buy a copy of this. It's very short, but it's a kind of diary of a mother with her first child. It's a very maternal, and so Tom went outside today and he looked at his son and he said, oh my, oh my, oh pretty, things like that. So he just loves words. He loves pencils. She was, thinking like most parents, I've got a gifted child. He's a genius. He's going to be smart. He's attentive to everything. That's the theme of that little book. Where it's really kind of interesting though, if you read this, Tom's Book by Ruth Jenkins, is the story of her mother-in-law coming to visit for the first time. And boy, is she panicked that her mother-in-law, what's her mother-in-law, do I clean? Do I cook? Do I do anything right? Is she going to tell me how I should raise this kid? I've never even had a kid before. She was just scared to death of her mother-in-law coming and what she was going to think of her. But she was very protective of Tom. She loved him. But she was very distant. She didn't seem to kind of even know what to say to him. And then she dies so early, and she disallows him to come into the hospital. Now his father is going to die a little bit later, but let me get to that. After his mother dies of cancer, they go back to the States for a little bit, but then they go back to France. His brother, John Paul, stays with some relatives. But Tom, young Tom Merton, goes with his father back to France. And at one point, Tom moves to England, stays with an aunt, begins attending school, and then later a man becomes kind of his, what's the word for someone who's not the parent, a guardian? is appointed guardian of him. And so he doesn't see his father. This is after his father's death, which is 1931. I think Merton is about 16 at the time, and his father, Owen, dies of a brain tumor. So Tom Merton doesn't have his brother around because he's living with relatives, and now his father has died. Now, after his mother died, his father, being a highfalutin artist and kind of a, you know, running around the world kind of guy, met other girls or other women, and so he had some other relationships, and Tom was watching this. This is the world he's in, and he's moving around. At one point, though, he goes to Italy, and he goes to Rome, and he goes to some art museums, and he is completely blown away by what he sees. The religious atmosphere, the climate, the paintings, the symbols, the sheer art of the art just pulverized him. It just knocked him down, knocked him for a loop. He had nothing to use to interpret what he was sensing. But it just drove just like a beam through him, and he could not resist the idea of beauty and art and meaningfulness existing. But he had not really experienced it in a normal kind of childhood, and so that was like another world to him. But after his father dies, 1933, Tom is 18. And now he moves, he travels to Italy, as I was saying, and then he moves to the United States, to New York, in the summer. So 1933, Merton comes to the U.S., and he's going to stay in the U.S. for the rest of his life until the final year. He returns to England, though, where he's gotten into some trouble. Now, this is one of the stories why Tom Merton may not become a saint officially, because he got a girl pregnant. Later, he fell in love with a nurse as he was a monk, and so that gets kind of a doozy as well. But the historians think that during World War II, that the young girl and the child were killed during the Blitzkrieg. So no one has ever been able to find any kind of track of their lives after World War II. And you remember the stories of that war and what Germany did in bombing England, London particularly. So he leaves for the United States. He lives with some relatives, but then he goes to college. So he's born kind of on his own. And he has this family, and he loves his family, but they all kind of disappear from him. And some people psychologicalize this story and say, well, that's why he went to the monastery. He needed a family. But that's not really what Merton wrote about. It's not really what was haunting him. What was haunting him was communion with reality itself. But he goes to college, and he's a brain. Thomas Merton, if you read his writings, you can tell he's intelligent. He wrote about 70 books. And I'm going to try to write my first book in my life this fall. 70 books. He died when he was 53. I'm already over that. So I was like, I'm so far behind. Even the monks were unprepared to realize how industrious he was as a monk, and how many writers and the correspondence he had. More about that a little later. He was just kind of a quiet guy like them. They had no idea what was coming out. It was just mushrooming from him. But he was very smart, so he did very well in college. He wrote for a magazine. He drew some illustrations, some of them kind of bawdy. He wrote a lot of poetry. He was political. He got in, as a lot of intellectuals in the early 20th century, he got into the Communist Party for a little bit, and then he got back out. Don't hold that against him. Just almost everybody who was an intellectual in the 20s and 30s and flirted a little bit with another system, because the world was clearly falling apart to everybody, and they were looking for something. What's going to hold things together? This is a spiritual understanding that Merton is seeking. What does hold things together? And he can't forget those art museums and the Catholic churches that he went into. Well, while he's at college, going back and forth to the school, he would pass this bookstore, and he would read everything. But then he started to read some religious books, and the first one that really opened his mind was Gilson's The Spirit of Medieval Philosophy. And what this did for Merton is, as a thinking person, he read somebody who was a thinking person but who was also religious. And he had no clue that that was possible. He had never heard of such a thing. He thought religious things and religion were diametrically opposed to being a thinking person. And he was a thinking person. And he was an artistic person, but religion didn't have anything to do with art. So that experience in Italy cracked open his world a little bit to where this beauty was religious. And he was thunderstruck by this. Well, then later, when he reads this intellectual French Catholic philosopher, his mind breaks open. And he starts to attend a Catholic church. He starts to read other things. And then all of a sudden, he wants to be a monk. He just sort of flips. He doesn't go to church. And then all of a sudden, he's got to go to church. And I don't just need to go to church. I need to go be a monk now. So this is a seemingly a wild swing, but it cannot be explained other than to realize that this was how he was motivated from the beginning. This was not just a spontaneous kind of flippant idea. His whole life was already oriented to show me what is real, and then he's just going to embrace that. And so when he just all of a sudden went religious, and then let's go full tilt, let's just be a monk. After partying, smoking, going to jazz clubs, playing the bongo drums, getting girls pregnant, he's already led the party life, kind of like Augustine did. But the whole time, he's born contemplative, I would say. And he's been contemplating reality, but he had no context, no forms to work with, nothing, no traction. And then when things started to click, he was paying attention to things that were clicking inside of him. And then he saw, he knew this is what he was supposed to do. And of course, he was, you know, right on target. He goes to the monastery, and that's where he stays the rest of his life. Has some problems there. But he goes there, and that started. So he becomes a member of the Catholic Church in 38. He goes to graduate school, goes to master's. He's an English major. So he does his master's thesis on William Blake. He's a poet. More about this a little later. Then he plans to go get his doctorate in English, and he's going to write his PhD dissertation on Catholic poet Gerald Manley Hopkins. But then when he decides he's got to be a monk, he scraps education. He was teaching at St. Bonaventure in New York. First, he applies in 1940 to the Franciscans, and they accept him. And then Merton has a second thought, and he calls them and goes, I don't know if this means anything to you, but I got this girl pregnant, and I just think I should tell you that. I don't know if that makes a difference. And they thought about it, and it kind of did make a difference. And they called him back and said, we're going to have to refuse you. Well, he went to some professors that he had at Columbia who were Catholic and knew something about monasteries. And one of them said, why don't you try the Trappist? They've got one down in Kentucky. So during Easter, Holy Week, he went down to Gethsemane. As soon as he knocked on the door and they opened it and says, hello, brother, something like we've been looking for you. He just felt he was home. He felt he was in, and not just home personally and psychologically. He felt he was home in the universe. He thought he had hit the heart of reality here. It's where he was supposed to be. But he had no idea. But he had a sensibility about it. So that was Holy Week. It is in April of 1941. December, right before Pearl Harbor Day, he starts to make his way on back down the bus trip train to Kentucky. And on December 10th, 1941, he entered the monastery at age 27. So he's had a family that's kind of disappeared. He's had an intellectual kind of an artistic upbringing, but void of orientation to things. But all this while, a very intense attentiveness to the meaningfulness of reality. This is it burdens him. Now, does that make sense? Have you heard this before? Is this do you have a sense? Keep this in mind now. So, if we flip to the back to the blue pages for a moment, I'd like you to turn the page over. The second one, page number would actually be number 4 on this thing. But conference number one, attention. Let me read this and kind of accent a few things, keeping Merton's story in mind a little bit. I'll talk a little more, then if you have some thoughts or some questions to get the day started, we'll open for that. So this is still from Thoughts in Solitude. He wrote this in 1953 and 54. Enters the monastery in 41. More about his life in the monastery, but he's writing in the early 50s. It's published a little bit later, 56 and then 58. So on attention, let us embrace reality and thus find ourselves immersed in the life-giving will and wisdom of God, which surrounds us everywhere. First, let us be sure that we know what we are doing. Faith alone can give us the light to see that God's will is to be found in our everyday life. To keep ourselves spiritually alive, we must constantly renew our faith. We are like pilots of fog-bound steamers, peering into the gloom in front of us, listening for the sounds of other ships. And we can only reach our harbor if we keep alert. The spiritual life is, then, first of all, a matter of keeping awake. We must not lose our sensitivity to spiritual inspirations. We must always be able to respond to the slightest warnings that speak, as though by hidden instinct in the depth of the soul that is spiritually alive. Meditation is one of the ways in which the spiritual man or spiritual person keeps himself or herself awake. I'm sure Merton would have used herself and she later. One of the gifts of Merton during his life was to women religious. They just loved him. Of course, he loved women. So there was a tension there. But sisters, with their conferences, there's a wonderful book called The Springs of Contemplation, which is a collection of transcriptions of the conferences he gave to a couple groups of nuns. And it's a beautiful book, and he's not writing, he's speaking. And when he spoke, he was much more fluid, candid, casual, informal. Especially when he was, and you could hear some of those nuns laugh and giggle even, and they were just, they weren't in awe of him. He knew something about freedom and liberation, and they felt really bound in the church. And he gave them a sense that it's okay to breathe. It's okay for the Spirit to move through you. It's okay to move left or right. It's okay to walk. It's okay to write your own writings. And he gave them just a wonderful sense of freedom. There was spiritual freedom, not a just gender-tied freedom, but a spiritual freedom. And I think it's because he was sensitive to spiritual inspirations quote, Merton was awake, and every day he tried to be awake. He tried to keep himself awake. He was born to be awake. Maybe all of us are born to be awake. But like Seneca, life kind of passes and we get caught up in all kinds of things that takes our attention away. That's why we have to practice centering prayer to come back to where our life is rooted. The silence takes us to God, particularly if we think that God's language is silence. This is where what we're trying. And that's our life. He is our life. I think what I value most about Merton's sense of reality, and that's his sense of spirituality. Spirituality is facing reality. It's not a way to do it. It is how you confront and face reality. What I value, I think, most personally in Merton's writings is the sense that he gives me when I start to, not simply doubt, but I start to question the Christian faith and what I do, and when I go to church, or when I practice prayer, or when I read scripture and I don't sense something. There's this plaguing kind of haunting sense that we can have as Christians that we don't talk about, which is maybe we're making all of this up. Maybe this is the Christian angle about life and existence and reality. And we're fine as long as we're in our Christian camp and with our people and our denomination and our group and our language and our books, and we understand ourselves. But all these other people are nuts and zombies running around. I don't know about them, but my sense of reality is this contained thing. Merton didn't have that. He was scared to death of falling into that trap that you would get in with a group of people and this would be the world. He knew from birth that the world was bigger than the little worlds that we create or the little lives that we create for ourselves. His term for this, for ourselves, was the false self. He says, God's looking at the false self. I don't know who this is. I didn't make this person. I would like to see the true self. And the true self is always sensible to the spirituality of reality. And I think that's what he's talking about here with the tension. So Merton could start any day calling out some bingo letters and numbers and then say, okay, that's that. We were just fooling. Let's pay attention now to our life. And he could just zip right to that depth. And this is what I'm saying he's meaning when he's talking about embracing reality. And then the second line in this paragraph, he says, first, let us be sure that we know what we're doing. This is a kind of scary thing. If you know what you're doing by routine and by regular practice and just regularity and just this is what I usually do in these situations, there's a comfort there. And there's a sense that that kind of stability, that's reality. Well, that's who I am and I can't change and this is the way I am and this is how I speak and all these kinds of things. If you embrace reality, though, in Merton's sense, it's going to have to disrupt one's own sense of the way everything is. And so you have to be ready for the way it is much different and bigger and maybe even better and more glorious, maybe scarier than the way you think it is. It's almost as if we go to sleep each day and then each morning we have to wake up. And we have to wake up in a spiritual kind of sense. And that's what we read at the beginning, the introduction of this book. His thoughts in solitude has put him in touch with the whole world. If he's embracing reality, he's not in his own mind. He's not in his own little world. He does not want to be there. He doesn't want to stay there. But that's comfortable. That's safe. That's what we know. Faith doesn't necessarily conform to that kind of knowledge. It doesn't have to oppose it. But it's something else. And what is that something else? This is what we're contemplating. It's not what we're grasping or getting. It's not what we're knowing. This is why the cloud of unknowing makes sense to us. So we can't say what it is. I really love films a lot, and I don't know how you think about movies. I don't know if is it okay to talk about movies on the Contemplative Outreach conference. I've seen some zingers lately, but I'm teaching a course on contemplation in the cinema right now. This is everybody's mad now because I'm in Florida. We were supposed to have movies last night, and it was going to be a rough one. But they're happy that I'm gone because my name's Gray, and everywhere I go it turns gray. So I came down here. And I promise you that when I leave tomorrow around 12:30, you're going to have blue skies by 1 o'clock. But the folks back home, they're kind of dreading. Here comes that film guy with the gray clouds. Again, it's going to break things up. There's a scene. This is a Hollywood movie. I really like foreign films quite a bit. The one that just won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film is called Ida. I bought it. I have not seen it, but I'm already recommending it to people. And it's about a young Polish girl who's going to be a nun. And I think, I don't know the story. I haven't seen it. But I think the mother of the house wants her to sort of find herself a little bit and go back to her roots and find some things out about her family. And it's the director who won the award, someone called me. I wasn't watching. I don't have cable, and said, "Gray, this sounds like one of your kind of movies." The director said, "You know, to Hollywood, it's amazing that this film won. It's a film about silence and contemplation. Who cares about that?" Well, I thought, "Well, I got to buy. How much is it? Doesn't matter. Let's just send it to me, please." So look for this. It's a black and white Polish film called Ida, I-D-A. It sounds like it's wonderful. It should be right up our alley. But the movie I was just thinking of was not something like that, but it was Close Encounters with the Third Kind. Now, there's a scene in this movie. They said, Steven Spielberg, The actor Richard Dreyfuss is driving his family nuts. He's got a vision of something and he doesn't know what it is. But he's sitting at the dinner table, do you recall this? And he starts heaping mashed potatoes on his plate. He's trying to build Devil's Tower, and I think is that in Wyoming? He doesn't know what he's doing though. But he had a close encounter with a UFO that kind of zapped his brain. And so he's everywhere, he's having this vision of this place, and he's got to go to, and of course he eventually does. The hilarious part is one day he's outside his house and he's digging in the dirt and he's throwing the dirt in and plants everywhere and he's throwing in the house and his wife is just, oh my gosh, what has happened to my husband? The kids are going, Dad, you are getting really weird. But to me, I've always identified with that. This was somebody who didn't know what they were doing, but they had to keep following it. They had to keep doing it. And everybody around them said, you're nuts, you're crazy. I feel like Merton must have sensed that. And even when he got into the monastery, some of the monks said, what are you talking about? That's not what we do here. Contemplation, we're doing something a little different. Some of them were a little resistant to what he was saying. But he didn't even know when he became a monk what contemplation was. He didn't go in to be contemplative. He just had to follow something. And as you go through his life and you read his words about the spiritual life, everything he wrote was just sort of coming out of him. He didn't sit down to write books about topics. He wrote things, and as soon as he wrote it, he was glad it was done. He didn't look back. He didn't reread things. He went on to the next thing. It's like almost as like journaling. If you journal, you don't necessarily go back. Oh, I remember that. That was I was so good then. You just keep writing because you're trying. It's not about what you're saying. It doesn't go anywhere. It is to get out. It is to get expressed. It's like the soul has to be expressed, and so you keep moving. Buddhists know about this when they do mandalas with sand art, and they make these exquisite designs, so intricate. And then within a few seconds after it's so beautiful, before you can pull out your smartphone and take a picture, they smear it all together. And you just cringe. If you've ever seen this, you go, oh my gosh, you really don't get it, do you? At least let us get a picture. But their sense of a reality, very much like Merton and like Richard Dreyfuss in that movie, is what is the life is not something you can possess. So the wind's blowing, you don't close the windows, and now you got it. You're going to lose it if you try to get a hold of it. And this becomes very radical. It almost becomes very political for people. It becomes very critical of economics at some point, and people get rather upset with some of his views as he starts to extrapolate on issues of the day and things. You know, fine, be a monk and talk religion. Don't start talking about the world we live in. Now you're kind of getting out of your reality zone. Merton was not about to be confined. And this, to me, is he's being attentive. He's trying to be as attentive as he possibly can to something that he cannot say what it is. And the author of The Cloud of Unknowing knows this. Let me stop for a second and see if we got 10:46. This is amazing. Is my clock actually slow? I can't believe, am I just talking too fast? Oh, is that, I can see that. Okay, so we're good. I was just showing a clock. Now, I came from a residence, and this is no complaint, Father Jim, but there were like 5 clocks in there, and every one of them was different. That's why I was a little late to prayer last night. I kept going from room to room. Wait, then I had my own, and I didn't trust my own time. Are you thinking anything yet? Would you like to? I mean, I don't know what's on your mind, but if we could take 15 minutes. And they're recording this, so they want you to speak in the microphone so they get your question. This lady would like to say something.
It's not a question, but it just came to me as you were speaking. I felt like Merton was like the wind and did not want to be contained.
Yeah.
That's what just came to me as you were speaking.
Yeah, I think it's... That's my sense of him. And when you read, if you read everything that he wrote, it is like his breeze. There's a beautiful chapter in the book, No Man is an Island. It was written in 1955. That was the first book I read of Merton's. And I grew up Protestant, and I found it in a Cokesbury Methodist bookstore. I don't know if anyone's a Methodist in here, or you were a Methodist, or you're going to be a Methodist. It's beside the point. And I saw it. I did not know what it was about. I didn't know who Thomas Merton was. But I felt like I needed to buy the book. That's how I got into reading Merton. No one had said anything. It's just the title just struck me. But I didn't know what to think of it. I couldn't read it. Four or five times I tried to read that book over the next couple of years, and it didn't make any sense to me. Then when I read it all the way through, and it was like the windows and the doors, everything flew open. It was like a summer house at the beach, and the breeze and the waves are blowing. At the end of the book, there's a beautiful chapter called "The Wind Blows Where It Pleases," and he's referring to the Holy Spirit. And you read, this is 1955, so this is kind of middle monkish years for Merton. But he's got that sense that the Spirit, like breath, like wind, is blowing through our lives. As soon as we're born, we're sort of swept into existence by birth, blowing through our mothers and our fathers and generations. And it's the Spirit blowing through everything. And it's a beautiful metaphor. It really is.
You were saying that we're born contemplative. And I was wondering, I have a 4-year-old granddaughter. How do you encourage that so that's not lost? Because I see that strain in her, and it's probably in all children that age, mm-hmm. that attention to every little thing, that curiosity, that just acceptance of what is.
Yeah, she's 4 years old. Mm-hmm. I've got two daughters, not that you need to hear anything about my life, but let me say something about both of them, and I'll come to your question. They were born 5 years apart. When I became a father, it was the first time I was a father. I thought all my life I would have sons. We didn't know what the first child would be. And so I'm there in the hospital room. She was born in Pennsylvania. I was going to Penn State at the time, and the baby was born, and I thought, it's a boy. It's a boy. I just figured it's a boy. It would be a boy. I'd sort of figure out the DNA of the both families and thought, this is the way it kind of worked. I was so surprised it was a girl, and I was just struck. What in the world am I going to do? I have no experience in... But somehow, the mystery is even deeper. How did I even think that I could raise a son? I had some preconceived notions about how a boy would be because I had been a boy and had grown up. So I was kind of like in-house in my mind. I was kind of working with an orientation that was mine and not really open to another person. So when my daughter shocked me in not being a boy, I had to just completely go to scratch. And I focused so much love and attention on her in those first few years we know is so important. And she's this dynamic, unusual mystery in my life, and everything was just glorious about her, and I spent as much time as I could. I spent a lot of time with her because I had time because I was in school. My wife was working. She's a nurse. When my second daughter was born, we knew that she was going to be a girl because there were complications, and we were prepared that this child would not be born normal, fully normal, whatever that means. But when she was born, my first thought, again, a kind of shock, how can I love a second daughter? Now, you're going to laugh at me, but this kind of relates to wind a minute and love and then attention. When my second daughter was born, I was struck. My first daughter's name is Carol. This one's named Ellen, both named after their mothers, grandmothers. I've spent 5 years loving 100% this girl, and now a second girl. And I thought, how am I going to divide my love between two girls, two daughters, and my wife on the side? So I've got these two daughters, and I was really sensing, understanding love itself as my capacity. Almost like I had a limited, I've got this 100% of love, 50% goes this way, 50 this way. But it dawned on me before we left the hospital that love did not start with me, did not come from me, it was blowing through me. That it was that the love that I loved these daughters, because almost within seconds my question was resolved, and I looked at the second daughter and I loved her with everything I had. And I was just amazed at how I could feel and think this way. They're both completely different. But my biggest concern as a father, in thinking, and I don't know if this is like wrong, errant, or radical thinking about we are born contemplative, but it's kind of how I understand things. So they were both completely different. And they went about kind of contemplating the world from my perspective, completely different. In as much space as we could give them, I wouldn't have any kind of parenting advice or anything like that, and I don't even think your question's asking that. How to get out of the way, though, to allow a child to grow up with what Merton didn't have, the sense that the world was wondrous, that it was huge, that it was okay to be lost. Both my daughters, I'm glad to say, one's 25, one's going to be 20 in a couple months. They're very strong women, but they have this suppleness and softness about them, an innocence. They're tough as nails in the world of boys and work and school. They can stand up for themselves, but they've got this mystical side, one a little bit more than the other. And I don't think there is anything consciously I could do except get out of the way and not be hands down on my children, like a parenting structure. I was already reading Merton for 20 years already before this, and I did not want to become a parental structure that confined, even if it was just to protect their world, but to pull back and trust God enough that there was a solitude for the family and there was solitude for those kids, and do not invade that. Do not invade that. I don't know how to coax it out of a child, but I do know that you can pull back from people and let them be. It's kind of like, you know, it's like what we know about detachment, and they're more present that way. But I think we can, no matter how they are and different they are.
How did you talk about protecting them and the innocence that they have. Was there anything you did that protected them, that helped them to keep their innocence?
Well, that's too hard of a question and completely unfair to ask me. I can't. I'm just kidding. I couldn't begin to take pride in anything that I've done as a parent. I don't think to even say, honestly, I think I did this and I did a good job. I'm kind of clueless still. But it would be untrue to say that I did not do my dead level best to protect them from the world, but it was not a political economic kind of protection. It was a kind of almost like protecting someone's soul and preserving that innocence and not trying to hurry them to grow up and lose that innocence. I think and many of you surely have experienced this. You still have an innocence. This is something about the purity of our soul. It's something about God in us. It's not our naivete or our juvenile, young, youthful silliness. Or we don't know what's going on in the world. It is something very pure about the spirit of life inside of us. That is our innocence. To protect that by regarding it as sacred and not forcing our kids to be religious in a certain kind of way, but certainly being religious ourselves in the best kind of sense, creates a kind of protectiveness for that soul. But I don't think that I'd have to say as a parent, and my wife and I have been pretty much in sync, but there's all these angels that must be working as well. I mean, there's all these other people. And if anybody's raised a kid, you're surprised about how they are. I mean, you kind of wonder would they ever turn out and do anything or something. But because you don't really have the power. I mean, you're kind of fighting the whole culture. And our children are kind of going off and following all kinds of other pseudo parents. And at some point you have to kind of raise your hands up and give up and trust God to raise these children. And somehow that's a kind of negative form of protection. That's a non-aggressiveness. Now, I would say that if we can kind of think in these terms, we can think of these terms in terms of people who teach students, people who work with anybody in the public and retail business, kind of appreciating our friends, not invading them, not attacking them, not concluding that this is all they are, looking at everybody that we know as completely open and wondrous and almost an abyss, that you can't get to know them and get to the bottom of them in a final kind of absolute way. And when people are open, and they're completely open to you, you're surprised and wonder about who they are and what they may say next. And that gives them quite a lot of room. I'd call it kind of a protective room to grow, to be themselves, to deal with themselves, to admit their wounds, their fears, their nervous feelings. And it lets people be. And hopefully they can be open to God if we're giving them that kind of surrounding help. That's kind of a communal thing. I hope I'm not sounding, I better not be sounding cliche. I'd like to be reckless still, but I think I'm losing my recklessness a little bit. Are we out of time?
Did Merton endorse, right here, Merton endorse any particular kind of method for contemplation, or was...
No, he didn't. One of his really neat essays is called What I Do Is... something like What I Do Is Wear Pants. People would write him constantly, what do you do, what do you do? And he was always just kind of struck that he had this sense that he didn't do anything special. He didn't have a way of living. He just lived. And we'll see this in some more of these quotes from Thoughts in Solitude, that the life in us just has to live. And it already has its own way of expressing itself without us designing things. But it's going to come out in forms. It's certainly going to come out through methods and techniques, but not because we've lopped them on and are kind of corralling that life. But in our limited way, we provide this kind of form for this wind to blow through. So there were all kinds of things that he did that we could call practices or spiritual practices. But I don't think he, beyond the regular routine of the monk and praying the hours, daily mass, those were just standards for him. They were natural standards in the sociological milieu that he was in, the context. But they were very free and open forms to him. Singing, praying the Psalms, it was just, that just opened him up completely. And for most monks, for any of you, if you read the Psalms daily, I mean, that's the prayer book of the church, of course, in the, but it's not saying something. It is reading something that opens you up and something gets said. So his idea of form is kind of stay away from form, but not in the liberal artsy, kind of way we say, well, you know, it doesn't matter, I'm just spontaneous. He was very industrious and methodical. But he was not conclusive and absolute about anything he did as that's what's doing it, or that's what's causing something, or that's how you get somewhere. Do it to be disciplined, but you're disciplined for openness. You're not disciplined to sort of rail that openness. But we'll talk a little bit more about him a little later in contemplation, and we might be able to say a little bit more about that. But he was kind of... By the end of his life, 68, he's hands off on structures and forms. These things are like concepts that get in the way of the flow of thinking. It's our way of harnessing reality for ourselves, not being open to it. I think we need to stop, right? Or we have one more? Take a break?
Gray?
Yeah. Oh, we'll just break in just a second. Yeah.
You know, one of the things I was thinking of as you were speaking was the fact that as far as meaning and purpose in life, the only one that can show us that is God.
Yeah.
And it's so important for us to realize that He's with us, He delights in being with us, and He will lead us, you know?
Yeah.
That was what was going through my mind as you were speaking there. So you don't have to comment on it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're completely right. And it's in the little quote that we had, faith for Merton was openness to that. And so any form could work. This is what allowed Merton to actually understand and appreciate other completely different religions. When he met somebody who was open to reality and open to embracing it without organizing it for themselves, he thought he was in the presence of somebody who was open to God. Whether they were Christian, an atheist, scientist, it didn't matter. And he would correspond with people all over the world. He would read people in every tradition. If you are open through the forms in which that open you, to him that's what faith was. And faith was not trusting your reason or your discipline or your heritage. It was trusting only God. And the Cistercians, which is the order he's a part of, their motto is God alone. And if you go to Gethsemane, there's a gate with the words over, and everybody goes by and takes a picture of that, because you really get this sense of this quiet place. Nothing matters ultimately except God alone. Anything else is in the way. Our thoughts, our words, our forms. But that was his idea of faith, was that complete openness to God, because God will give you the light. God will give you... We say that, but then, but let me tell you what I think. He was quite sincere. No, be completely open. Really.
15-minute break.
Okay.